This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In 1970, Ariel Dorfman went to work for Chilean President Salvador Allende. It was a heady time in Latin American politics. Allende was a Marxist who had come to power as the democratically elected leader of his people. But his socialist reforms threatened established business interests in Chile and the United States. His government was overthrown, and Allende died of gunshot wounds in a coup d'etat backed by the United States. The violent overthrows sent Ariel Dorfman into exile. Dorfman has since written two memoirs, his latest, Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile. It follows him from the time he left Chile and chronicles his attempts to return to his homeland. Ariel Dorfman will talk about the new memoir tomorrow at Perkins Library on the campus of Duke University. But first, he's in the studio with us today. Ariel, welcome. Good to have you back.
I'm so glad to be here again, Frank.
When you wrote your first memoir, did you see the sequel? Did you know that you'd have to write a second?
Well, you know, when I wrote the first memoir, what happened was that during 9 months, and I'm not joking, it was 9 months, I thought it was only one book. And then I couldn't fit it all into one book. And then all of a sudden, like really like a birth, I said, this is two books. And I thought, you know, the second book will come or it won't come. But I knew that the first book had to be up to the coup, because what I wanted was to center it on the days in which the coup happens, and then I'm hunted to death, and then I escape death. And so while that is happening, while I'm losing my country, while I'm trying to resist exile, simultaneously, I'm telling the story of how I became that person who was gaining a country, Chile, only to lose it. So there was this ironic back and forth between the past, as I remembered it, and a present of danger. And so when I decided to do it that way, I said, okay, well, someday, maybe I'll write from 1973 onwards. But I never thought I really would, I mean, unless there was an urgent reason to do so. And the urgent reason came up, and I decided that there was a second part to this, and there may even be a third one. Who knows? And I'm very pleased. I began, and I thought this is going to be an easy book to write, because I know about all of this. In other words, you know, when you're speaking about when you were a kid, you have these vague memories of things, and whereas all this was during the period when I was writing, so I had all these chronicles, all these diaries, all these things. And that made it more difficult.
Why?
Because you're sort of tied to what you've written already. And what I had to do is really get rid of all that and start again.
Could you go back and kind of contextualize it and just say to yourself, what was I thinking when I was writing that? That's one way around it.
Well, you can do that. But what I came up with as a solution to this, I mean, this spans basically 20 years, 20 intense years, from 1973 to around 1991, 92, something like that, but also has an update for the next 20 years. So it's almost 40 years of my life. It's a lot to fit in there, especially when you think about all the people I met and all the countries I went through and all the experiences I had and all the changes that occurred in me, the languages I changed, coming to Durham, that itself would be, there could be a whole book in that. So I decided to do the following. I said, what is the central event of these 35, 40 years? What is the event that I can put in a present, just as I put the coup, where chapter after chapter I was being hunted down? What is the sequence that I can speak of in present? And I realized that it was in 1990 when General Pinochet lost, and he became just the commander-in-chief of the army, from where he threatened us constantly, but he no longer was the president, and he was beaten twice in democratic elections. When I went back to Chile, in other words, when Chile went back to democracy, I went back to Chile definitely, and I spent 6 months there, and I had spent 17 and a half years, almost 18 years, trying to go back to Chile. And therefore, I said to myself, well, this is my return. So I take those 6 months and I put them in the form of a diary, which I did keep. This is very similar to the diary that I had. Mm. So I rewrote that diary where day by day I explain what it's like to come back to your country after having left it. And then very slowly the disenchantment with the country, realizing that I have changed and the country has changed, my dreams have changed, and therefore the country is no longer the country that I expected it to be. And then in alternate chapters, much longer, I begin to tell the story of the exile. So again, it's the same system, which is In one sequence, I'm slowly losing Chile, losing my country. And in the other, I'm crazily trying to return.
And you did. And as you suggest, it was not a triumphal entry for you. Tell us about that as you slowly lost that vision and your sense of how wonderful it would be to come back. It wasn't that. Talk about
the
disenchantment.
Well, you know, I think you have to go back in the sense that when you leave, and the first words of the memoir are, all I wanted to do was return home, to find a home to return to. Because I had, just to put the back story, I had been already exiled as a child, 2.5, from Argentina, and then from the United States when I was 12, because I left the United States for Chile. So the fact of leaving a country that I had adopted as my own and losing everything, my friends, my home, everything but my family, let's say, right? And the cause that I believed in, which is the cause of justice and fairness and beauty. I hadn't lost that. So this desire to return both led me to a series of drastic mistakes, which may not have been mistakes because they gave me a lot of experience, but they certainly made me suffer enormously. And they made my family, particularly my darling wife, Angelica, suffer enormously. Because I kept on sacrificing everything for the struggle against neo-fascism and the repression.
What mistakes? What mistakes?
Well, a typical mistake is when I was offered refugee status, I said, I'm not a refugee. I'm an exile. And therefore, you know, I don't accept refugee status, which means I don't get a house. I don't get a visa. I don't get money to help learn the language of the country. In other words, there are a series of things that refugees get, supposedly. You know, some refugees don't get anything except a dry camp and a lot of dust. But some refugees, or let's say the privileged ones, which I was among them, would get all these things. And I said, instead, I put myself at the service of the resistance. Send me where you want. And they sent me to Paris, which was the worst possible place to go without any money. You know, I mean, I first said, what can I do for the resistance? And then I said, how am I going to make my living? And I couldn't. It was very, very difficult. So that's a typical mistake.
And it was very difficult for your wife, particularly in Paris.
Particularly difficult for her, you know, because she didn't want to go to Paris because it was a harsh and cruel place. It's not our favorite city in the world. But, you know, now I'm a person who has many books in French, and I did a film with Polanski. I mean, so this is a different Ariel Dorfman who comes back to France, you know, and not exactly the same one who would go through the streets and people would say to him, when I would go to buy a pastry or something, they would say, come back when you learn how to pronounce the word.
Yeah, well, they'll still say that.
Well, they'll still say that, but my answer would not be the sort that I could repeat on this program without you having to bleep it out.
But your wife had to change her status, and that was very difficult.
Well, yes, I mean, but I think that what I discovered was that I wanted to suffer. In other words, I had such survivor's guilt. I mean, there were people who died instead of me. This is literal. I can't go into that, and I shouldn't because it's in the other book, but people that died instead of me. So I felt that in some sense, the people back home, those who hadn't left, those who hadn't fled the country, even if I had been ordered, I was ordered out of the country, so it wasn't my decision in some sense. But I could have stayed. I could have said, you know what? I don't care. If they kill me, they kill me. You know, I believed in these things. I should stay here. So I think there was this sense of punishing myself and also of saying, I don't want to use my status of privilege, my green eyes, my blonde hair, my many languages, my class. Basically, I don't want to use that to protect myself. I want to be like the poor are, like the people in Chile are. You know, and that you can't get rid of certain things unless you're a saint, you know, which I'm not.
Well, how much of that do you think affected your reentry when you went back in 1990? Well, not only your perception of yourself, perhaps survivor's guilt as you described it, but also how other people perceived you. You did live through this thing. You were privileged and had the chance to travel abroad while others were suffering.
Well, I think that's one of the things that happened in Chile. I mean, that you know, while we were fighting Pinochet, because I did go back several times before the dictatorship ended, and I was even arrested and deported with my son Joaquin. So we did not have an easy time of it. And I mentioned a lot of those things, you know, being beaten up, stuff like that, which are very secondary to the things that happen, you know, to most of the people in Chile. But still, they were harsh experiences, and the experiences of fear, and the experience of a country where you're not free. Those are things I learned about when I went back. But while we were all together fighting the dictator, there were no cracks, or at least if the cracks were there, you didn't notice them, right? There were little snide remarks like saying, oh, yeah, well, some people don't have publishers abroad, you know, because I'd already been published in 20, 25 languages when I went back to Chile. Some of us really had a hard time, you know, like that. You would let those things pass. Now, when I came back, I found that, in fact, many people, too many people of the cultural elite, for two very different reasons, thought of me as somebody who had, in fact, used my exile for things to go well for me, you know, which is partly true and partly false. You know, I mean, nobody's going to publish you if you write in a lousy way. I don't think, you know, and in fact, most of the books that have made me most famous are the ones I wrote after exile. So nobody put Death and the Maiden on because I was in exile, because I wasn't anymore. And nobody published my Heading South, Looking North book, or nobody did films on me because of that. So it's not quite true, but there's enough truth in it for one to say, okay, you know what? I came back to Chile. I'm going to keep quiet. So I said, for the first 6 months, I'm not going to write at all. And then, of course, I began writing Death and the Maiden. But you were saying about the dreams. So you come back, and what keeps you going when you're in exile is you have a certain image, almost a utopian, idyllic image of the country, because that is the only thing that is permanent. In other words, the country back home is being ravaged. The house where I grew up as an adolescent was razed in the sense of R-A-Z-E-D. It was destroyed, and they put up a big block on top of it, a six-story building on top of it. Friends were killed that you could never see again, you know? In other words, the country was being raped, and that violation happened constantly. What the reaction to that is, I will keep it intact in my mind. I will keep that dream of what the country is, should be, and will be when I return. And then you discover that it has been so contaminated by the dictatorship. Or maybe you discover something even worse, that it never was the way you thought it was, that was a construction to begin with. So I thought that constructing the memoir around this slow discovery of how damaged the country was, while at the same time discovering how wonderful the country was. But it's like having a dream of something and then going and facing the reality day after day after day. And it's that slow movement which I think gives a certain tension to the book, because in the other section, I'm telling the story of my exile. And I'm telling how I served Chile, but also how I also discovered myself to be a different person, how I was changed by exile. In other words, how the person who returned was not the person who left.
You are not the same person. It's not the same country. It may not have been the country you ever imagined. All of those ideas in such flux. And you did write Death and the Maiden while you were back in Chile at this time. It's a play that's been well received everywhere except Chile.
Well, in fact, at this moment, they're doing the third production, and it finally has been very, very well received in Chile.
But
and,
not then. How did
but
you?
No,
what,
no.
What was
then,
happening then?
Well, then
how
what was happening
feel?
Was... I mean, I have two very contradictory needs. One is I want to be loved, and the other is I want to pour salt in the wounds of everybody and disturb them. And these two, you know, the sort of troublemaker Ariel and the gentle Ariel clash continually, or maybe schizophrenically live together. And I conceived this play. I didn't want to write it, basically, but nobody in Chile was interested in what I found to be the most fascinating human and dramatic problem which was there, which was that there was the coexistence between those who had persecuted you and the persecuted. In other words, a woman was tortured, and she might find on the bus or in a cafe or in her house one day when her husband brings home a man who helped him on the road, she might hear the voice of the man who raped and tortured her to the music of Schubert. And so this was the country. And I said, nobody's writing about this. And I waited, and I asked friends, and they said, no, we don't want to speak about those things anymore. So I found a country that, strangely enough, during Pinochet's era, had fought ferociously for the right to speak. And once they were able to speak, they decided to be silent. And strange enough, this is something that happens. It happened in the Czech Republic. It happened with the South Africans. I mean, Death and the Maiden was the most popular play in South Africa. And the South Africans were saying, how did you do it? This is what we need to do. It's very strange, you know, that, and it happened in many places. And it may have happened because during many years, I was in some way anticipating what would be to return to Chile. So I wrote the play, and people kept on saying, you know, we're not sure this is the time. And I said, if not now, when? I mean, what do you mean it's not the time? This is my gift to Chile, I thought. In other words, what better gift to the transition than to show in a mirror the damaged, fractured soul of the country? But, you know, when you're a monster, you don't want to be shown the mirror, right?
Or at least not then. This business of when and who's the author, that the South Africans would take that mirror written by a Chilean or Argentinian, if you want to talk about the place of your birth, author is okay with us, but you can't be one of us.
Right, but they can see it as allegorical. In other words, they can see it about South Africa, but it's not exactly about South Africa. Where in Chile, it was exactly about Chile, even if it was about some country which might be somewhere.
Would it have been better received, do you think, had you not written it in Chile? Do you think that would have made a difference?
But you know, this is the point. I wrote it in Chile in 3 weeks. As soon as I finished writing it, I began rewriting it in English because I wrote it in Spanish. And I rewrote it in English because automatically I realized as I was writing it that I had written it in Spanish, but the perspective was that of an exile. In other words, if somebody, anybody who had spent the 17 years of dictatorship in Chile would never been able to write that. They didn't have enough of distance. They weren't able to do something as challenging and as provocative and as troublesome as have the man who was presumably the torturer be the victim and have the woman who's been raped beating him up. In other words, I turned the tables so that we would ask ourselves, what has this done to us? And I did something entirely unpardonable, which was, and partly unforgivable, which is I took the human rights lawyer and I made him into a man who was flawed and imperfect. And of course, only if you've been far enough. I can remember with my mother-in-law, I would think, if I had to write with my mother-in-law reading me the next day, I would not be able to write. I mean, you know, when you meet the milkman, you can't sort of mock him. I mean, some people can. Molière can do it. Other people can do it. I can't do that. So in some sense, the isolation, the fact that I was rejected as soon as I returned, the very people who I had sent money to help them, they would invite me to their meetings, to their houses, to even to their readings, you know. They ignored me, sort of saying, okay, he thinks he's such a big thing, we'll make him suffer. So I was very isolated. And the result of that was, that isolation in some sense was a godsend.
So I was going to ask you, because then you write about the pain, the suffering, the isolation of the exile, but this is it not the role of the exile to be?
Well, it's not only the role of the exile, it's the role of the writer.
So but does the writer have to be in exile? Does the writer have to be a stranger in his
own land?
I think
every writer's finally got to be an exile in some sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the writer is the loneliest profession, and it's the most communal profession. Loneliest because you're really alone by yourself with that blank piece of paper, that screen now that we've got, right? Or whatever we've got there. But there's nothing there until you put something down. And you're struggling with yourself. But inside you are many voices, and outside you are many ears. And many readers or many spectators, they're waiting for you. And what you discover in your loneliness and your solitude tends to be something that they recognize as theirs. They recognize it as true. It isn't true until you've discovered that truth. Now, that was something that I knew intuitively, but I had not discovered until I had gone through the process of exile. So exile became for me, in some ways, the worst thing that could have happened to me. And in a terrible sense, the best thing that could have happened to me. At least if we understand that the result was the sort of person or the sort of writing that I do now, which in general, I'm very pleased with. And it's not only, by the way, I don't only write, you know, about torture and about repression and things like that. And I just wrote the lead story in The Atlantic about a man who wants to recover all the books that he wrote because he thinks that it will reveal a love affair that he had in the past. I mean, I can go on and on. I'm in some sense liberated from having only to write about one thing. I don't want to be pigeonholed in one little form of saying this is who I am. I contain multitudes. I may not be Whitman, but I do contain multitudes.
Ariel Dorfman, what a pleasure. Always great to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Frank. I'm glad to have had the chance.
Ariel Dorfman teaches at Duke University, and he is the author of Feeding on Dreams, Confessions of an Unrepentant Exile. Ariel Dorfman is going to talk about this new memoir tomorrow at 4 o'clock at the Gothic Reading Room at Perkins Library on the campus of Duke University. You can find more information on Ariel Dorfman to go. You should go to adorfman.duke.edu. Just ahead, we talk about a new development that aims to shelter homeless vets in Wake County. Stay with us.